This is Ozarks at Large for June 4th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Bentonville Art Walk, part of the month-long Bentonville Art and Culinary Festival, celebrates the visual arts Friday, June 7th, that's this Friday, and Saturday the 8th on the downtown square. It includes over 30 visual artists from around the country and free live jazz music. DowntownBentonville.org or 254-0254 for more information.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we talk to an economics professor about corruption and the role it plays in regulatory compliance. Plus, a pharmacist discusses an increase in adult immunizations in Arkansas, and we analyze a new state law that addresses the illegal carrying of a weapon.
First, the Secretary of State's office has released a draft of rules for implementing the voter ID law passed during this year's legislative session. Alex Reed, a spokesman for Secretary of State Mark Martin, says lawmakers delegated some rulemaking powers to his office.
The law that was passed by the General Assembly, it gave authority to rulemaking, where we have to propose these rules about the machines and about the cards that voters will need to go in and vote. And so what we did is our legal team put together this set of draft rules to kind of go over what's going to be on the card, how somebody gets the card, and what you need to get the card.
The draft of rules contains numerous forms of documentation that will need to be provided to county clerks starting next year. Governor Mike Beebe opposed the legislation, saying that in-person voter fraud is exceedingly uncommon and that voter ID laws tend to prevent registered voters from voting.
It's been more than 2 months since the oil spill in Mayflower, and concerns remain over the timeline of events. Discrepancies of minutes can mean thousands of additional gallons of oil and toxic fumes. On the day of the spill, Exxon reported pressure drops in the pipeline at 1:15 in the afternoon to the National Response Center. More than a week later, Exxon's website posted that same pressure drop as occurring over an hour later. The NRC says audio of the conversations confirms their reports. Attorney General Dustin McDaniel says he does not believe there is cause for concern over the timeline.
I don't have any specific reason at this point to characterize anything as discrepancies. I mean, I recognize that there are going to be different times of responses for different agencies, different levels, different phone calls.
In Mayflower, residents had to inform authorities with a call at 2:44 in the afternoon. Exxon was then contacted by local authorities at 3:19 and arrived nearly 30 minutes later. But in reports, Exxon claims to have arrived on the ground at 3:15, 4 minutes before local authorities contacted them.
The Friday flooding of Fouche La Fay River in Scott and Yale counties was, by some accounts, a record. Jason Funkhauser is with the U.S. Geological Survey in Little Rock.
Well, we had heavy rains in the area at the USGS Fouche La Fay River Gauging Station near Gravelly, which is in western Arkansas. We recorded somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 or 4 inches of rain that evening, and that's not all that unusual, but what's unusual is that periodically during that time, that evening, we received as much as an inch of rain in 15 minutes, which is very unusual, very heavy rain.
Though the USGS is still analyzing data, Funkhauser says the river rose more than 30 feet as a result of the storm, the highest peak measured at the Gravelly site since measurement of water level stages began in 1939. Funkhauser says the flooding event was larger than the 100-year, or 1% flood level, and was likely closer to the 500-year, or 0.2% flood level, meaning that every year there was a 0.2% chance that a similar flood could happen. He says this storm differs from other significant flooding events in recent years.
Well, the last widespread flooding that Arkansas experienced was in 2011. This was a lot more localized, somewhat similar to what happened a few years ago down at Albert Pike, where you just had one very heavy cell that set over an area for a length of time long enough for a flood to occur, a massive flood like this.
Funkhauser says during the weekend storm, many of the monitoring gauges across the state experienced between 2 and 5 inches of rain. Scott County, home to part of the Fouche La Fay River, was one of 6 counties that Governor Mike Beebe on Friday declared disaster areas after recent tornadoes, strong storms, and flooding.
The new youth tennis courts at Wilson Park will open this week. A court opening celebration is scheduled for 5:30 to 7 Friday evening at the Fayetteville Park. The court renovations were made possible by a two-court renovation grant from the United States Tennis Association. Chase Gibson is the recreation superintendent for the city's Parks and Recreation Department, and he says the court renovations were conducted to keep pace with national youth tennis trends.
What that includes is resurfacing the courts and then converting one of the courts into four youth courts. So as part of the resurfacing project, this is a big push that the USTA is making for 10 and under tennis, kind of catching up with other sports in that they're trying to adjust the parameters of tennis, like the size of the playing surface, the type of ball you use, the type of equipment you use, to make tennis more friendly to kids age 10 and under.
He says the new courts are specifically designed for younger tennis enthusiasts, something that, until now, hasn't existed in any of Fayetteville's parks.
We're excited about the possibility of kids getting out there and playing and, you know, kids being active, and any opportunity that you have for children to be active and you have facilities to accommodate the children coming and being active, then that's something that we're excited about, whether it's a, you know, playground or a baseball field or a soccer field or a basketball court.
In addition to the opening of the new youth tennis courts, the Wilson Park pool will also open beginning at 4 p.m. Friday. Admission will be free on opening day, and the opening evening will also kick off the park's dive-in movie series with a viewing of Madagascar 3 beginning at sunset. The movie series is sponsored by the Fayetteville Firefighters Association, and it is free to the public.
Fayetteville has again made a list of the cheapest places to live in the country. According to Kiplinger Magazine's 10 Cheapest U.S. Cities to Live In, Fayetteville ranked fifth. The list was based on the Council for Community and Economic Research calculations of living expenses in 307 urban areas. The publication lists Fayetteville with a cost of living 14% below the national average, a median household income of just under $36,000, and median home values at just under $178,000. Key to Fayetteville's ranking is the fact that while salaries aren't big, unemployment in the area is below the national average, and paychecks stretch further because of low housing, transportation, and utility costs.
Tonight's weather forecast calls for mostly cloudy conditions with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, and lows from 63 in northwest Arkansas to 67 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms, with highs from 81 in northwest Arkansas to 85 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow night, expect mostly cloudy conditions with a 70% chance of showers and thunderstorms, and lows from 62 to 68 degrees. This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas General Assembly passed several new gun laws in Arkansas during the 2013 session, most notably Professor Carry and Church Carry, which allow for permitted concealed handguns in certain churches and institutes of higher education.
But another new law, Act 746, some say aims to decriminalize the open carry of handguns in the state. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the new law has received minor mainstream coverage, but is major headline news among gun rights advocates.
Under the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, we the people have the right to keep and bear or carry arms for lawful purposes. States, however, have jurisdiction on where and how we can carry our guns. In Arkansas, no state permit is required to purchase or possess a gun, but if you wish to carry a loaded gun on a journey right now outside of your home or neighborhood, you must conceal it, have a license for it, and obtain training and a permit proving to law enforcement that you and it are legal. Open carry, the right to carry a loaded handgun in full view in public, is outlawed in Arkansas. That's why advocates for open carry over the last three legislative sessions have pushed for enactment. Open carry legislation failed in 2008 in 2011. But according to Nicholas Staley, a spokesperson for the gun rights group Arkansas Carry, the 89th General Assembly has sanctioned open carry with the passage of Act 746.
Okay, well, there are two pieces to Act 746. The first piece is they've simply defined what a journey is. They define a journey as leaving your home county. The second thing that it does, though, and this is a whole lot bigger and a lot of people miss it, is it actually changes the intent. Instead of the prosecutor having to prove that you intended to use it against a person, he actually has to prove that you intended to unlawfully employ it for use against a person. So what that means is that unless you're violating some other law, unless you're robbing or you know, stealing or, you know, committing some sort of crime with that gun, then the prosecutor really can't charge you for carrying a firearm.
The law on transporting loaded guns in Arkansas has been fuzzy for years, even though the so-called Journey Law traces back to the mid-19th century.
The Safe Journey Law, which came about, you know, right after Arkansas was readmitted into the Union after the Civil War, and it's actually a Jim Crow law. And so this law has been on the books for a very long time, and there was no clear definition of what a journey really was.
Act 746, sponsored by Denny Altus, Republican Representative District 63, Fort Smith, is House Bill 1700, amends Arkansas Code 573-120 regarding the illegal carrying of a weapon. Gun rights advocates interpret the change to mean that Arkansans can now openly carry a loaded handgun without a permit or a license. Nicholas Staley says Act 746 places Arkansas under the rubric of being a constitutional carry state, joining five others, including Vermont, Alaska, Montana, and Wyoming, which don't restrict the carry of handguns for purposes of self-defense. But Art English, a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Arkansas Little Rock, says the new law is far from constitutional and could be reckless.
You know, my impression of this legislation is that some of it is covered by existing law or existing practice, and some of it is just extraordinarily vague and probably unconstitutional.
So how will Act 746 work with new state gun laws, including church carry, the right to bring a concealed weapon into any Arkansas church, or professor carry, the right to bring a concealed weapon onto a college campus? Gun rights advocate and Arkansas Carry spokesperson Nicholas Staley.
People need to make sure that they have permission from the church if they decide to carry. As for the professor carry, you know, at the time we didn't take a position on it because we didn't particularly like it. It did a couple of things structurally to the law that we aren't just too fond of, and I won't go into the detail of it because it's very wonky. But what I will say is that, you know, the only way these schools are ever going to allow professors to carry is if the political appointees to those boards are comprised of people who are pro-gun. And there aren't a whole lot of pro-gun people in education, even on the Republican side. So I don't really anticipate that any schools in Arkansas will be allowing any kind of concealed carry on campus anytime soon.
Nicholas Staley admits he won't be stepping out in public with an openly holstered handgun come August 16th, but expects others to openly carry.
You know, our advice to people is to go get a concealed carry permit and carry concealed until this thing has been, you know, really heard out in the courts, because, you know, we don't want people with careers and families and reputations to wind up getting arrested and charged under this law. And even if you win, you know, you have to defend yourself. So there will be people who want to test it.
Now, in their press release, Arkansas Carry suggests that open carry activists secure the opinion of a lawyer first before publicly packing heat. Both Arkansas State Police Director Stan Witt and Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe have gone on record saying Act 746 does not convey the right to open carry handguns in Arkansas because the law is so vague. Multiple queries to various academic criminal justice institutes yielded both hands up due to the law being untested and so vague, so they couldn't really comment. And Washington County Sheriff Tim Helder said he had to consult with County Prosecuting Attorney John Threet before he could comment on the record for this story on the new state law, and they agreed little has changed.
When I actually read through the law, I didn't notice all the significant changes that everybody else has identified. I think the one thing that I did see that was clarified was the definition of journey.
Sheriff Helder says his deputies typically will cite or arrest an individual for illegal carry of a concealed weapon during a traffic accident or DWI investigation and don't specifically target for it. But come August 16th, when Act 746 goes into effect, he will prepare his staff to deal with open carry being acted out in Washington County.
Oh, I think there'll be some because there are people that are trying to push this issue. They're looking for the right to do that. I think a lot of them believe that it's their inalienable right anyway to do that.
According to a Pew Research Center national study released last winter, several months after the Sandy Hook Elementary massacre, a majority of gun owners say that having a weapon around makes them feel safer. The study also cites that gun use has dramatically shifted from recreational use, such as hunting and target shooting, towards protection, 48%. Up from 26% in 1999. The survey found that a majority of Americans would also support stricter gun laws to blunt increasing mass shootings, which have taken place in recent years. But conversely, they also worry that stricter gun laws would limit self-protection. Oklahoma late last year became the 44th state to allow open carry. And according to media reports there, 6 months after enactment, both authorities and advocates claim it's been a non-issue. So, given that Act 746 may portend a soft start for open carry in Arkansas, as many gun rights advocates believe, Arkansas could, passing muster in the courts, eventually become the 45th state to allow it. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
As pop culture would lead us to believe, corruption of public officials leads to less compliance with the regulations that those officials are tasked with monitoring. But in reality, that may not be the case. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis recently spoke with a University of Arkansas economics professor about corruption and the role it plays in regulatory compliance.
Fabio Mendez was on vacation with his wife when he experienced corruption firsthand. The two were in the midst of a car trip to the beach, a trip that he says would normally take between 4 and 5 hours. It wasn't an extremely long trip, but as Fabio puts it, it was just long enough to gain an incentive by going slightly over the speed limit. And then the couple drove past a welcoming sight.
I wasn't speeding much, but she kind of noticed I was going above the limit. And as we were going through the highway, she noticed a traffic officer on the side of the road, but the traffic officer was clearly sleeping.
Though he says his wife was put off from the apparent corruption, Fabio took advantage of the snoozing patrolman.
I was inside myself a little happy because then I felt like I could speed without consequences, so that'll make my trip shorter and the whole day better. So I continued to speed, and the conversation ended. But then about an hour after or so, I was stopped by a traffic officer who came out of nowhere. You couldn't see this guy.
But this officer didn't have as much of an apparent hands-off approach to enforcement as did his sleeping comrade down the road. When asked by the officer, Fabio produced his American driver's license and travel documents, and that's when he ran into problems.
I says, well, but this really complicates things because you have a foreign license and, you know, the formal procedures are complicated now. We would have to file this form, but to file the form, we would have to go downtown. And right now, I think the offices are closed. I don't know if you can make the process today. And then, of course, we have to go downtown, but I cannot let you drive because your wife does not have a national license. No, she doesn't have an. Oh, well, then that's a problem. We cannot let her drive either. So you guys would have to find a medium of transportation, and you cannot leave the car here because that's against the law also. So you would have to find somebody to take the car for you.
After unraveling this tree of consequences, the officer kindly offers another option, an option that would let Fabio and his wife avoid the bureaucratic hurdles.
Then the guy says, of course, there's another way, because I could, all this is paperwork, I could really deal with the paperwork, and then, you know, I would just give you like a temporary permit to drive, and then when I go back to the office this afternoon at my own expense, then I would file the paperwork for you, and you would just have to pay the price of the normal ticket. I could do that for you and we can help each other. And it was very clear that the option that I had was horrible. And not only horrible, but probably very legal, right? Very according to the laws. So I got the message.
Yes, the officer was asking for a bribe to make the infraction easier to swallow. Fabio paid the bribe and his speeding ticket to avoid additional hassles during his vacation, but it was a statement that the corrupt cop made after receiving the bribe that stuck with Fabio.
He says, "Mr. Mendez, by the way, I know that you're going towards this area of the coast, and let me tell you that if I was you, I would not speed because there's others like me along the road." And I said, "You know what? That's great." But that last comment stayed with me as I started driving. And I said, "Well, I don't want to go through this again. I mean, this is horrible to go through." So, and then on top, I have to pay more money and then get slowed down again. So I stopped speeding.
Fabio is an economist at the Walton College of Business at the University of Arkansas. With this scene stuck firmly in mind, he had an idea for his latest paper on corruption.
If it's possible, to me, then it can happen in many different areas. And it is true. Right? You can imagine sales taxes. You can imagine health regulations. You can imagine restaurants and their codes that they have. So right there, once you start driving, once you're in that chair, you feel it. This is happening. So I didn't have to think very, very hard the formalities of the paper and how to model this into an academic work that has not only validity but has a logical background, a theoretical model, some empirical verification to it. Yeah, that's the academic process, but the bluntness and the obviousness of the answer was right there in front of me.
The paper in which Fabio outlines these ideas was recently published in Public Choice, a journal that focuses on the connection between economics and political science. He says that the paper hinges on the idea that when public officials who monitor regulatory compliance are paid a fixed wage, corruption of those officials can follow.
The trick is to notice that the people or the agents that are not complying with the regulations, they don't care whether they get caught by an honest or a corrupt official. They care about getting caught. Now, the officials, whether honest or corrupt, in order to catch these guys, they need to monitor economic activity. So if you have a taco shop and you don't want to pay sales taxes, well, how are you going to get caught if nobody comes and verifies that you're paying sales taxes? So the public officers that make sure these regulations are followed, they have to monitor. Now, their incentive to monitor depends on what they get paid.
But that notion isn't one that has been deeply explored by others who study corruption.
To me, it was clear after many years of working in this field that the literature is very harsh and is very clear on how corruption is, under all circumstances, pervasive, and it makes regulatory compliance decrease. So it was obvious to me that there was a gap in the literature and a contribution to be made. It turns out that most people that had looked at this issue had, and I'm not going to say ignored, but overlooked the fact that most civil servants get paid a fixed wage.
He says that if officials who are paid fixed wages were instead paid a commission on their actions, the converse would be true, in that corruption would actually hamper regulatory compliance.
So in the case of the police officer, you get to see that the guy would not sleep if he would be paid a commission on the tickets he writes. But to me, economics is not only what should be and what the best world would be, but it's also writing about the real problems that we face every day. And it turns out that most public officials get paid a fixed wage. So under those circumstances, is it possible for corruption to foster compliance? And the answer that I found, at least in this paper, is yes, it is possible.
But for his paper to stand up to scrutiny, Fabio had to find empirical data to back up his hypothesis. So he turned to a data set compiled by the World Bank. The data was a collection of survey data from firms who self-reported on several areas, but amongst the questions asked were ones pertaining to how much the firms paid in bribes to avoid paying taxes.
Now, of course, you would like better and better detail and better data. This was the closest thing that I could find to what I needed. So in this survey, firms are asked, how much did you pay for concepts of bribes related to tax avoidance? And at the same time, they were asked a set of other questions, no? Such, for example, how much of the sales that you should report, you report. So like that, you can measure regulatory compliance. In this case, the regulation will be sales taxes paid, and the firms self-report whether they paid 100% of what they should have paid or not.
Although the self-reported firm-level data has some measurement error, Fabio was able to use the data to get an idea of the amount of regulatory compliance as it pertained to sales tax collection versus the amount of corruption or bribes paid. While he says that the data doesn't absolutely confirm his theory, the data provided a positive correlation that he used to support his theory. But Fabio says that one thing must be kept in mind when making any statements about what effects corruption has on regulatory compliance.
If you were to make a statement and say, well, when corruption goes up, regulatory compliance goes down, it's very easy to say when corruption goes up and then the rest, but it's very hard to put meaning on that sentence. Corruption goes up. Well, what does it mean?
Fabio says that measuring corruption could include many variables. Variables such as the amount of each bribe paid, the number of times the bribe is paid, or the number of regulations that are being broken. The list could go on, which is why Fabio says that economists need a better overall understanding of corruption so that better tools for measuring corruption can be developed so as to study corruption more empirically rather than abstractly.
This inability of people to make the jump from an abstract notion of corruption that you can also say dishonesty. But, well, just like you cannot measure happiness, just like you cannot measure honesty, well, it turns out that you cannot measure corruption in the abstract, and then you need better tools, better measures to do this. And then I think once people educate themselves and make that jump to say, okay, you know what, if I want to study corruption, if I want to talk about corruption, I need a better sense of what I'm talking about, then this story is not so hard to understand.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Good day. It is Tuesday, June 4th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me is Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Okay, we're still on the topic of music. Two very different kinds this time. A touring band coming to George's Majestic Lounge tonight for an 8:30 show called Murder by Death.
Okay.
They are touring behind the September album, Bitter Drink, Bitter Mood. They're from Indiana. And What's Up Music writer Kevin Kinder describes them as their music as desolate, brooding anthems.
Well, that's kind of what I would have gathered.
It sounds to me sort of like going to hear Nick Cave, which I call music to commit suicide by. So it's up to you. $8.30, $12. If you're a little more upbeat, tomorrow at 2 at the Fayetteville Public Library, some of their summer music, a band called the Pop-Ups. They've gotten Grammy nominations. They perform using cardboard props, hand-painted sets, and puppets, which is much more my style. And it's free.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday night, beginning at 10 p.m. On this Friday edition of Shades of Jazz, we'll hear music from the Pat Metheny Group, John Stetch, comedian and jazz vocalist Leah Delaria, pianist Leslie Pinchik, and much, much more. I hope you'll tune in. That's this Friday at 10 p.m. for Shades of Jazz.
KUAF is supported by White River Nursery in Fayetteville, now offering vegetables, herbs, spring annuals, and gardening supplies. Open 7 days a week with a full variety of native Arkansas trees, shrubs, and perennials. 442-2061 or available on Facebook for daily updates and information. NOARC, Northwest Arkansas Human Resource Association, presents Emerging Trends in Workforce Development and Advocacy in Action June 13th at the Springdale Holiday Inn. Artie Williams, the director of the Department of Workforce Services, will speak, and political representatives will discuss the legislative process and how to effectively get involved. Registration is required. NOARK.org for more information.
Fishing may only place second to golf when it comes to recreation in and around Bella Vista. Most fish that come out of the seven man-made lakes there are species familiar to native Ozarkers. But a new species, also sort of man-made, is being introduced to a pair of small lakes. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums recently found out more.
Have you bass fished Brittany yet?
Not Brittany. I haven't been to Brittany. Before I got the boat, my brother and I, we did.
On a windy May afternoon, Daryl Bowman, the lake ecologist and fisheries manager for Bella Vista, is talking fishing with a visitor to Lake Norwood. If the fisherman is successful, he'll likely catch one of a handful of species common to Ozarks lakes, according to Bowman.
Largemouth bass, channel catfish, bluegill, red ear sunfish, and crappie, and in this case, black crappie. And so, for instance, these kids fishing right here have just been catching some small bluegill and largemouth bass. That's what you're going to catch.
But maybe someday in the future, a hook dropped into the 35-acre Lake Norwood could come back out of the water with a different kind of fish, the sawgeye, a hybridization created from the genetic parents of walleye and sauger. Daryl Bowman says the fish has recently been introduced to Lake Norwood and another small lake in Bella Vista to fulfill requests made by local fishermen. After all, Daryl says, fisheries management for recreational lakes like Lake Norwood have three elements: the fish, the habitat, and the people.
This is really people management when it comes to recreational lake management like this. And we have people, especially in Bella Vista, but really if you think about all of Northwest Arkansas, because of our economy, we've brought in people from all over the world that live here now. And Bella Vista is historically a retirement community, and there's a lot of people retire here from northern states, and the big sport fish there is walleye.
But stocking walleye in southern bodies like Lake Norwood has proven problematic. The sauger, from the same biological family, does well in the south, but only in big rivers. So the sawgeye, created with the sperm of a sauger and the eggs of a walleye, may work.
State fish hatcheries have figured out how to hybridize the two, which they've become good at, to make a sport fish that is well adapted to these small lakes. So by putting sawgeye here, that's my way of providing a walleye fishery, because if you pick one up or eat it, it's a walleye. Same thing.
The sawgeye is a sleek, toothy fish and quite the predator. In fact, its voracious appetite means the sawgeye stocked into Lake Norwood are all small, each about 1 inch long. Larger than that, and the fish have a tendency to dine on each other in transit. When Daryl Bowman is asked what precise science is used to make sure that the effort to get the sawgeye into the lake works, he offers a wry response.
It's incredible science. You put it in there and see if you catch some later.
Well, I mean, you got to think about it. You don't want too many, or
so. It's really a good point, and that's why this strange issue of hybridization in sport fish is interesting to me, because you hit it right on the head. One reason hybrids are valuable, there's a few reasons, but one is that they don't successfully reproduce. Because their genetics are fouled. Right. And there's some argument there. Some of these hybrid strains can actually go through processes of reproduction, and on occasion even successfully spawn, but it's very rare and you have to have a lot of things happen at the same time. So sawgeye, we can control their numbers, and that is the science behind it. You don't want a fish to overpopulate.
Concerns about overpopulation are tempered by two factors. First, the sawgeye's small size at introduction, a certain amount of them will end up as meals for largemouth bass, and second, the fact that the fish cannot reproduce on its own. So Daryl, for now, is managing a numbers game. Enough introduced to survive, but not so many that other species are bothered. There is no absolute guarantee the project will work, that the sawgeye will take to Lake Norwood. The uncertainty, Daryl says, is just part of fisheries biology.
A lot of things in nature, nothing happens rapidly. And it is. It sometimes, I guess you could say, it's frustrating, or at least it's you have to have some level of patience to see, you know, if you're in forest management, if you're in aquatic resource management, whatever you're applying to the situation often takes a long time to see if you're getting results.
And transplanted fishermen from the northern Bella Vista hope that soon they can have a fish in Lake Norwood that's much like their beloved walleye, a fish they love for the challenge of the sport as well as the taste.
And, you know, I like diversity. I like things that are different. I like doing something different, and I get tired of the mundane. And I think there's an element of that in the angling community. And so that's one of my goals here in working with Tommy Bailey, our general manager, since we created my department in 2007. We wanted to try to add a little bit of diversity to these fisheries, because, like I said, it's the same five sport fish basically in all seven lakes. So where we can, as these lakes have these little individual differences and possibilities, we're trying to add a different sport fish here or there.
For now, Daryl measures, watches, and waits. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
You can hear more from the conversation, including three more questions Kyle asked Daryl Bowman, at our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com.
Dr. Eric Crumbaugh was a retail pharmacist specializing in immunizations when he was recruited by the Arkansas Pharmacist Association 2 years ago. The organization received a $1.8 million grant and cooperative agreement from the Center for Disease Control. Part of that required a pharmacist to go into pharmacies, working with the pharmacist to make it easier for them to offer immunizations. I spoke with Dr. Crumbaugh over the phone last week. I began our conversation by commenting that on my last visit to the doctor, she suggested being immunized, something I hadn't heard in quite some time.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot more emphasis being placed on adults and their routine immunizations, just because we've had a lot of outbreaks of disease just across the country. And one of the reasons for that is just because people aren't protected.
So it isn't just because our doctors are more thorough than others. There really is a new interest.
There's a big push not only from the local health departments, but also from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and a lot of the other federal agencies, and a lot of other places in healthcare, because it's such an easy intervention. And it really does save a lot.
So what types of diseases are we talking about? What sort of immunizations?
The three immunizations that we focused on for our program were influenza vaccination, pneumococcal vaccination, and the shingles vaccination.
Okay, so the flu, pneumonia, and shingles.
Mm-hmm.
We hear of, you know, children needing vaccinations. Are these ones that children and adults both need?
There's two points that need to be discussed when you talk about why adults need immunizations. Mm-hmm. For flu, you know, for a healthy, you know, I'm about 30 years old. So for a middle-aged adult, I have a small child. So if I were to get the flu, it wouldn't be that big of a deal for my health. Like, I would probably get some medication and be down for a couple of days, and I would recover. However, if I were to give that to my young daughter, who is 3 months old, or if I were to give it to my very old grandfather who has a compromised immune system, it could be deadly in them. And so it's important not only for me to be vaccinated to protect myself and to keep myself from getting the disease, but also to protect the ones around me.
Right.
And then when you look at some of the other vaccinations, so shingles, for example, shingles is a disease that we normally think of in older people, so people over 50 or 60. And if you've ever seen somebody with shingles, you know how serious that disease can be. That disease is not necessarily life-threatening, but it can be life-changing.
Yeah, it's not comfortable. I've never had it, but I know people that have.
And then when you talk about the pneumococcal vaccination, we think of pneumococcal disease, a lot of times we think of people that are over the age of 65, just because we see a lot of disease in them. But we also are seeing more and more invasive pneumococcal disease. So that's the serious pneumonia where they're in the, you know, intensive care units in the hospital, and they're on several different antibiotics because that pneumonia or that infection is resistant to antibiotics. And we don't think about it a lot, but a lot of times when we have a condition like diabetes or lung disease or liver disease, that puts us at an increased risk for that pneumococcal infection, and so by getting vaccinated, we can decrease our risk substantially.
Makes sense. You know, how did you get this information out to pharmacists?
So one of the first things that we did was we established an online toolkit, and basically this toolkit was available to all Arkansas pharmacists, where they could go in, and it was a step-by-step on either how to set up your immunization program or how to improve your immunization program, and not only like the documentation and, you know, the clinical aspect of it, but also identifying patients and how you work it into your daily workflow and billing. And so we took that toolkit, and it's available on our website, but we also made a printed toolkit, and we sent this out to every single pharmacy across the state. A couple of months later, we developed some signs that talked about vaccine-preventable disease, and we sent those signs out to all of the pharmacies across the state, and they were able to display those. So even if they weren't actively engaging their patients, the patients may see those signs and may ask the pharmacist about those vaccines.
In the grand scheme of things, it's not really that old. I mean, pharmacists haven't been able to give vaccinations for that long, according to your release. I mean, it's just in 1997, so barely 15 years.
Right, and it's one of those things that it was passed in 97, and then they incorporated it into the pharmacy curriculum in 2001. So you've got about 10 years worth of pharmacy graduates that have had this education and that have had this training, but they got out and they may not have used it or they may not have renewed it. And so another component was us providing education to the pharmacist. We had a program that is actually licensed through the American Pharmacist Association, and we've had 117 Arkansas pharmacists complete that program.
Pharmacists that previously were not giving immunizations?
Yes.
So how many pharmacists at this time are giving immunizations?
Right now, if you look at the number of pharmacies that offer immunizations, when we started this program, there were about 750 pharmacies across the state, and about 47% of those offered vaccination services. And through 1 year of efforts with our program, when we resurveyed all of the pharmacies, we were up to about 52%. And now you have to take into account we had a lot of pharmacies close because of the USA Drug or because of the Walgreens and USA Drug merger.
Right. I know a couple of USA Drugs closed here in Fayetteville where
and,
I live.
Yeah, so. And all of those USA Drug stores were offering immunizations. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of took away. So
you're a doctor. I mean, you go through extensive training and, so people shouldn't be nervous to just walk into Walgreens or Collier's. It's totally safe and
absolutely. And I mean, it's not only is it included as part of the pharmacy curriculum, but if you do offer immunizations to renew your license or it's your authority to administer. So that's your extra license that you get as a pharmacist to offer immunization services. You have to have so much continuing education every year to keep that current.
Well, let's talk about the number of vaccines that were given and how those numbers increased. It looks like they increased by almost 300% from 2011, 2012 to 2012, 2013.
Yeah, I think it's just an increased awareness. So not only were we talking to our pharmacists and telling our pharmacists to engage their patients and talk to them about vaccinations, but we also had a couple of efforts through our media outreach, where we actually went on the air on some of the local news stations and actually gave vaccinations to people. We vaccinated one of the infectious disease branch chief on one of the local news things and said, so we tried to not only hit it from the engaging the pharmacist, but we also were engaging the public to go to their pharmacy and ask their pharmacist about what immunizations they need.
Is the cost different, from going to my doctor to just walking into Walgreens?
It depends. So okay. Insurance coverage is kind of a tricky animal. And so it just kind of depends on who your insurance is through. And in some instances, it may be cheaper to go to your physician's office. But then in a lot of instances, it's actually cheaper to go to your pharmacist.
Dr. Eric Crumbaugh is a pharmacist with the Arkansas Pharmacists Association. Their program continues for another year. He says the goal was only a 10% increase in immunized adults this time around, yet they saw a 300% increase. He is hopeful that word of mouth will continue and that they'll have another 300% increase this year. For more information, visit arrx.org and click on the Immunizations tab. This is Ozarks at Large.
American pianist Simona Dinnerstein recently collaborated with Tiff Merritt to create a new album, and Ozarks at Large's Katie Hendrickson has this review of the project.
I'm just going to put this out there right away. Don't Listen to Night, a new collaboration between folk singer-songwriter Tiff Merritt and classical pianist Simona Dinnerstein, if you aren't in the mood to cry.
Is that only in the songs? I guess the blues, that's where I belong, if that's.
Now, as a child, I was raised on classical music, but folk, jazz, world, and rock all had a place in my home, too, whether it was on the record player, the radio, or maybe even MTV. I'm a child of the 80s, after all. There wasn't anything strange about playing Mozart on my violin while adorning a giant fluorescent lace bow inspired by Cyndi Lauper. As a music lover, I've always been drawn to simply what I call good music. Genres are artificial borders constructed primarily for marketing ploys. And as both a classical music host and an arts producer here at KUAF, I love that I can program a Scarlatti keyboard sonata and then go interview the lead singer of a doom metal band. It's all in a day's work for me. I have the idea that a song by Billie Holiday can speak to a song by Purcell, and that each one can influence the way we hear the other, Simona Dinnerstein says. Now, that's a quote that speaks to my heart, and indeed these massively different songs, 15 of them, weave together to form a whole unlike anything I've ever heard. Collaboration from musicians of drastically different genres certainly is not a new thing, but when it happens as well as when Tift Merritt and Simona Dinnerstein come together, well, that's certainly a feat. They're releasing the album on none other than Sony Classical, too. That's another feat in itself. Now, The New Yorker said of Dinnerstein that she's the pianist of Generation X. Born in New York City in 1972, she's got the classical pedigree, attended Manhattan School of Music, then Juilliard, and went on to a residency at Tanglewood, launching her as one of the rising stars in the classical world. Merritt's ascension is much different. Born in Houston, Texas in 1975, she moved to North Carolina as a child and came to music singing folk harmonies along with her father. On paper, it looks like their only similarities could be their Gen X status and the fact that they're amazing musicians. The two became connected when Gramophone magazine arranged for Merritt to interview Dinnerstein, and the rest is history. Well, I am really excited that Gramophone brought the two together, because what we have in Night is a remarkable piece where Billie Holiday informs Henry Purcell, who informs Schubert's Night in Dreams, remade as a cowboy song. Merritt says Dinnerstein could see the piece as a cowboy song, and Merritt's addition of harmonica adds just the right touch. There's also a Dinnerstein original arrangement from Leonard Cohen Tunes, and the album begins with a Merritt original, Only in Songs. They've called this actually a song cycle, and they were on a tour all spring performing that song cycle live. It's an experience to listen to Night, and one that you will want to bask in for a long time. Night is one of those rare collaborations in which Merritt speaks of, that willingness to extend yourself to a new place, but in a way that does not feel like anything has been given up. In Night, it doesn't matter if the composer is long dead and classical, from a jazz idiom, or the music comes from Americana traditionals. It all comes together right here in Night. I really recommend it. It's a beautiful album of gorgeous songs. And again, it will make you cry. That is, if you're like me. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world of woe. The There's no sickness, toil or danger in that bright land to which I go. I'm going there to see my father. He said he'd meet me when I come. I'm only going over Jordan. I'm only going to my home.
The FBI has transformed over the last decade from an institution that fights drugs and organized crime into a bureau focused on intelligence and counterterrorism. So if that's the story of the last decade, where will the bureau go in the next decade under a new director? I'm Ari Shapiro, the future of the FBI, its leadership, mission, and challenges. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation, just ahead at 1 o'clock here on KUAF.
Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
The Artisphere Festival Orchestra, featuring more than 80 musicians from around the world, returns to Northwest Arkansas for 12 classical music events this month. Two concerts will take place at Walton Arts Center, including An Evening of Beethoven June 21st and Russian Masterpieces June 28th. Tickets and full lineup available by calling 443-5600 or on the web waltonartscenter.org.
KUAF will broadcast Mozart in the Museum live from Crystal Bridges Museum of American Arts on Monday, June 24th at 8 p.m. Hosted by Kyle Kellums of Ozarks at Large and Katie Henriksen of Note, Walton Arts Center CEO Peter B. Lane and Crystal Bridges President Don Bacigalupi. This live broadcast will feature the Artisphere Festival Orchestra. More information is available at artisphearefestival.org. Support for this broadcast comes from Cox Communications and the Bentonville Art and Culinary Festival.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Ozark.
Excellent.
And I say Ozark because you were just near there over the weekend.
I was. I was at Mulberry Mountain for Wakarusa. Went down Thursday for a little bit. It was a lot of it got rained out Thursday, actually. We spent a lot of time just hanging out in the campsite. We had a canopy, thank God.
So you weren't stuck in a car.
No, we were not stuck in a car. We had a canopy so we could be outside in nature, but relatively dry. And unfortunately, a lot of shows were getting canceled and whatnot. I mean, obviously for the safety of the bands and the patrons, lightning and things like that kept them away. But I did get to see, you know, the headlining act that evening, The Black Crowes. And so they came back here and did the show and got to talk to Kyle a little bit about it and then went back Friday for the weekend. And it was a good weekend considering. It was the muddiest mess I've ever seen in my entire life.
Right. I wanted to go so bad and then started seeing pictures of people like knee high in mud.
Yep.
And I mean, I'm not necessarily a fair weather person, but
yes,
I did not envy you in knee-high mud.
Yes, it was quite the adventure. I did get to see lots of bands, and it was a lot of fun, and just camping in general is interesting. Camping during a storm, I hadn't done that. Friday night was interesting. Some canopies got knocked over, so lots of tents got destroyed. We were fortunate in that ours did not, so it was a good time. But while I was there, got to me and some of the people I was with got to take some pictures, and we've posted those on our website, so you can go to ozarksatlarge.com and see some of the muddy mess that you may have missed out on.
Sounds good.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. We will both be back with more news.
Yes. Have a good Tuesday.